Possible with support from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, imported foods from around the world, featuring a selection of international European cheeses, olive oil, balsamic vinegar, spices, and more. World Harvest Foods, at the intersection of 6th and University Avenue in Champaign, encourages you to join them in supporting public radio. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning, in the first hour of the program, we'll be talking about American politics, and our guest is Robert Reich. He's professor at Brandeis University, and during the Clinton administration served as Secretary of Labor. He has written a lot about American politics. His writing has appeared in various places, The New Yorker, Atlantic Monthly, New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal. And this morning we'll be talking about a book that he's authored. It's just out recently. It is his 10th. By the way, the title of the book is Reason, and the subtitle is Why Liberals Will Win the Battle for America, and it's published by Knopf. And in the book, he makes the argument that despite the fact that conservatism in this country seems to be in the ascendancy, he says that most Americans on most issues are liberal. And that the reason that the left in this country hasn't been more successful politically is that it is disorganized, and that the Republicans have done a much better job of organizing. He says that there are some things that Democrats can do so that they would be more successful in politics, and not necessarily taking over all of politics, but having a greater voice than they do now. And he lays that all out in the book. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. All we ask people is that they're just brief so that we can keep the program moving and get in as many people as possible. But of course, anybody's welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line so that if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. And it is 800-222-9455. At any point here, if you have questions, you can give us a call. Professor Reich, hello.
Well, good morning, David. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
I'm great.
We appreciate you giving us some of your time. Well, certainly one thing that we know is that the voice of conservatives in politics in America is today very strong, and it has been growing over probably the past couple of decades as part of a long project of people on the right to have a strong voice. And we know that they have organized well, and they have done well in organizing and maintaining their base, that they have a very strong voice now in the American media. All of this has meant for Republicans and for conservatives a great deal of success in politics. On the other side, when we look at liberals, Democrats, it's virtually the opposite picture. Less well-organized, not quite the same kind of voice, and in terms of, the makeup of Congress, who's in the White House, maybe even how state legislatures look, Democrats, liberals, or whatever, people on the left, whatever label you want to apply, have not, at least of late, been quite so successful. I guess maybe let me ask first, you could talk a little bit about what conservatives have done and why it is that conservatives have been in recent decades so powerful and have such a strong voice.
First, David, let me distinguish between what I consider to be radical conservatives, or I call radcons in my book, and traditional conservatives. Traditional conservatives, for example, are very prudent about fiscal policy. They don't want big budget deficits. Federal budget deficits or state budget deficits. Radical conservatives tend not to be nearly as concerned about deficits. In fact, at the federal level right now, we're running deficits in the order of $400 billion year after year after year, as far as you can see into the future. Secondly, traditional conservatives were very, very careful and wary about American foreign policy, about the use of American force and military power abroad. They wanted to make sure we did it carefully. We had an exit strategy. We knew why we were doing it. We did it with our allies so we wouldn't be caught alone. But radical conservatives tend to be quite eager to use American military power, even without our allies and even without much of a pretext for doing so, witness Iraq. And finally, traditional conservatives were very concerned about the quality of public discussion. They talked a lot about their concern in terms of the coarsening of American culture, the dialogue, that trash talk. They didn't want to indulge in any of that. But radical conservatives seem to be engaging in a great deal of mudslinging. They seem willing on their radio programs and television programs to do a lot of accusation, a lot of kind of politics of resentment, blaming various groups and various people for the problems that others have. I think radical conservatives have been successful because they have turned their politics into a movement. They have got very, very strong funding from a couple of major family foundations, such as Richard Mellon Scaife, from some big corporations. They have utilized right-wing evangelical Protestant churches and denominations at the grassroots to help spread their message, and they have really gone into league to some measure with those who don't want to see a sharp divide between church and state in this country. And finally, radical conservatives have honed a language of phrases such as tax and spend liberal or politically correct or class warfare or limousine liberal or any of the other phrases that come so quickly to mind. And these phrases and slogans tend to define a political universe, a way of looking at the world, so that people don't have to think very hard. They can just use the slogan.
You know, one thing that when we go to this question of Democrats or people on the left and their lack of organization, one thing that really struck me, I think this it might have been last year, I don't know, I was looking at some polling that was done by the Zogby organization, and what they were doing was they were looking back to the election of 2000 and looking at those people who had at that time supported President Bush and the then candidate Bush and those who had supported Vice President Gore, and asked them questions about how they felt on certain really signature issues that should say, are you a liberal or are you a conservative? And among the things they found, one of the things that they found was that that things had changed very little, that the people who were defined as Republicans still were and the people who were defined as Democrats still were. But the thing that really struck me was when you looked at people's responses to them, some of these hot-button issues, it seemed that on the Republican side, there was much more unanimity of viewpoint. They seemed all to be on the same page. You look at the Democrats, and there actually was diversity of opinion on some of the key issues, things like abortion and gun control and those things that are supposed to tell you definitely who you are one way or another. And it seemed to me that that is a real challenge for the Democratic Party. That is, there is more diversity of viewpoint, and that makes it harder for everybody to get together, agree on a platform and a strategy and a candidate.
Well, that's true. About hot-button issues like gun control and abortion, you're absolutely right. Democrats have a much, much wider kind of disparity, a difference of opinion. And yet, if you look at the fundamentals, David, for example, should there be a strict separation between church and state? Almost all Democrats and many independents say, yes, we don't want to force anyone to adhere to an established religion. We don't want to require anybody to adhere to one particular religious faith. If you ask people, is it a good thing that corporations have so much power in America, that they're paying their executives 500 times now what the average worker gets, and firing workers with impunity? Most Democrats and most independents, in fact, many Republicans, would say corporations have way too much power. And then if you look at foreign policy, if you look at Iraq, all Democrats and many, many independents, and if you believe the polls, quite a number of Republicans now, are deeply worried. Most Americans now believe that our policies in Iraq are creating a greater danger of terrorism rather than a lesser danger. So you're right about certain hot-button issues. Democrats have a great deal of of disagreement. But when it comes to the fundamentals of foreign policy, domestic policy, culture, I think there actually is a great deal of unanimity, not only among Democrats, but really among all Americans.
Well, that I think that gets an important point, and it's an argument that you make in the book, is that if you look at a broad range of issues and you go out and you ask people how they feel about these things, you're making the argument that, in fact, most Americans are liberal.
They don't call themselves liberal because the term has taken such a bashing over the last 20 years. But when it comes to actually whether you believe in these liberal causes without labeling them liberal, most Americans do come around. For example, the environment. Should companies cut pollution more? Most Americans say absolutely yes. Should there be affordable universal health care? Most Americans say yes, even if that means that there ought to be a little bit less of a tax cut. And by the way, most Americans don't believe they got very much out of that the Bush tax cuts. Mm-hmm. Most Americans believe, accurately, it turns out, that the lion's share went to people who are very wealthy, over $200,000 of income per year.
Well, let me ask you one further question, and I have a number of callers here. Well, I want them to know I'll get right to them, and I'm sure that these are the same questions that everybody asks you right up front and any time that you talk about this. Given the fact that if you look at their attitudes, that most Americans do line up kind of on the liberal side of things, even though, as you point out, that people don't identify that way, that if that's the way their attitudes go, why is it that Democrats have not been more successful politically if most people would be in harmony with the Democratic Party's kind of platform and orientation?
Because Democrats have been have lacked organization. Many of them have, particularly the elected Democrats, have lacked the courage of their convictions. Some Democrats, too many in my view, have been drinking at the same trough in terms of political contributions as Republicans, depending upon large corporations and very wealthy people. And once you do that, you are more reluctant to voice your opinion that, for example, large corporations have too much power in our society. And that has hurt the Democratic Party. I think the Democratic Party, if it's going to have a future, has got to turn itself into a movement representing the needs and goals of average working people in this country.
Hmm. Well, I think that a lot of people, when they look at where the Democratic Party is positioned in the spectrum of American politics, and if they are concerned and if they believe the party has lost some of its signature values and it has drifted toward the center, one guy that they finger is responsible for that drift is Bill Clinton, who they would say it wasn't that the party drifted, he grabbed it and dragged it over to the center. And some people might also further argue that that's why it is that he was successful and managed to get himself elected. And I wonder if you think indeed that either or both of those things is true.
Well, I was very proud to have been a part of the Clinton administration. It presided over the most successful economy we've had in the post-war era, generated more jobs, presided over an economy that generated more jobs than any other administration has presided over. Your point, though, I think is well taken. Bill Clinton did try to undertake what he called at the time, I think Dick Morris called, triangulation. Remember that term? That is, position yourself equidistant from the Democrats and Republicans. And I think it helped Bill Clinton because the public doesn't really like partisan politics. It doesn't like the president to be a strong partisan. And I think it helped him get reelected. And he did reposition himself in a kind of the political center as it was then defined. But I'm not sure it helped the Democrats define themselves. In fact, it may have made it more difficult for the Democrats to define themselves. I remember, Dave, one instant, in fact, and I guess it was 1994, after Newt Gingrich and his group had been elected and taken control of the House of Representatives, I gave a speech in which I railed against corporate welfare, against all of the tax breaks that big corporations get, and talked about how it would be better to use all of that money instead to provide people with better education and better health care. Well, Democrats did not like that. I mean, not only did the White House not like that term, corporate welfare, but many Democrats in Congress thought that they were just too fighting words. I was being too provocative. But ironically, it was the Republicans who then took up the word. They were the ones who made a list of what they considered to be inappropriate corporate welfare and went after it and popularized the term. And I think that exemplifies maybe a lack of, again, a lack of courage among Democrats, some Democrats, not all, by any stretch. There are some very courageous Democrats in Congress and elsewhere, but a lack of courage by many Democrats to stand up for average working people and, again, against the increasing concentration of wealth and power in this country.
We have a number of callers to bring into the conversation. We will do that right now, and let me introduce again our guest, Robert Reich. He's university professor at Brandeis University. He's also a visiting professor at University of California, Berkeley, and he served as the Secretary of Labor under President Bill Clinton. His current book is titled Reason: Why Liberals Will Win the Battle for America. It's published by Knopf, and we have a number of callers. The lines are full, so we'll get right to it. The first person in line here is in Normal, Illinois, on line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, Dr. Reich. I'd like to talk a little bit about the tax policy, about when you make a massive tax cut like was made and then increase spending at the same time, isn't this in essence a tax increase we either do with less services at the state and local level or raise our taxes there, plus the interest that we pay on this massive debt is approaching $1 billion a day, if I'm not mistaken. So we pay $1 billion with nothing back in return. And don't the conservatives get part of this $1 billion when they buy the bonds, the rich people in this country? I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
The caller's point is exactly right, that when you run a huge budget deficit, that is increased spending on, for example, the military and other things that the Bush administration has increased spending on, Homeland Security, may be necessary, but at the same time provide a huge tax cut in the order of $2 trillion, the lion's share of which go to very wealthy people, then what you are really doing is not cutting taxes because average working people have got to pay more. They have to pay more in terms of local services, municipal services. State taxes often go up because the states don't have nearly enough money to deal with all of the problems that they have to deal with because the federal government is cutting back. Also, the caller accurately stated that we pay more interest on the federal debt. The interest to the federal debt is paid by, well, eventually by normal taxpayers, average taxpayers. And where does it go? Well, it goes to people who buy government bonds. And most of the people who buy government bonds are wealthy people who used to pay a lot more taxes. Now they support the government through essentially lending the government money. Everybody else has to pay them back. So we do have, at a time in our nation's history when the gap in income and wealth between the top and bottom, in fact, every rung on the ladder of income and wealth is wider than it's been in over 100 years, we have a tax policy that is biased against working people, often against the poor, because so many social programs have to be cut, and makes the rich even richer.
All right, let's go to Champaign, the next caller, line 1. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to raise the issue of Ralph Nader and the Democratic Party, if I can, briefly, and then hear your response. Particularly this morning, I saw an article in the New York Times which said that Ralph Nader is now receiving support from the Reform Party, from conservatives, and actually from the Republican Party in various parts of the country where they're assisting him in getting on the ballot. And yet at the same time, Ralph Nader seems to have support from the left wing of politics. Some people who used to be or still are Democrats and aren't happy with Kerry or whatever. So I'd like to hear your response. I'll hang up. I appreciate your speaking on this. Thank you.
Ralph Nader is a friend of mine. I've known him for many years. I am enormously impressed with the work he did in the 1970s, 1980s, in terms of making consumer products safer. But I think he's doing a terrible disservice to the nation right now. A vote for Ralph Nader is, in effect, a vote for George W. Bush for a second term. If anybody had any doubt about that, they have only to look at the 2000 election. Al Gore would have won even by a larger margin. I mean, he obviously did win the popular vote, but the Electoral College went to George W. Bush. But George W. Bush would not have had a chance if Al Gore had got a large portion of the votes that went to Ralph Nader in 2000. So there may have been an excuse for somebody voting for Ralph Nader in 2000 who wanted to move the country a little bit more to the left, but there's no excuse now. We saw what happened. And anybody who votes for Ralph Nader who has basically liberal or progressive values is deluding themselves, seriously deluding themselves. The caller noted correctly that Ralph Nader is now being supported by Republicans, conservatives, the Reform Party that supported Pat Buchanan last time around. There's no mystery as to why this is occurring, because Republicans and conservatives and those who are Pat Buchanan-type conservatives as well, they all know that a vote for Ralph Nader is a vote for, in effect, George W. Bush, and they want to encourage people on the left to vote for Ralph Nader. This is a pernicious influence in politics. It is going to hurt John Kerry, I hope not too much, but again, Ralph Nader is doing a major disservice to the country.
On again, let's go to, I believe we have a caller on cell phone line number two. Hello.
Yes, I'm quite an advocate of your especially some of your statements and what you've done in the past, and I want to congratulate you for bringing up the term corporate welfare, because it's really had been unrecognized for several decades. And but with my point, getting back to your theme here about how the liberals are losing this battle, I think if we and I think Clinton had the right tone. I mean, he was the first Democrat that went after the welfare system. And going back to in history, where the Puritans had a, they would arrange their government in a certain way, and they made a statement that they just don't want the rich to be too greedy and the poor to be too lazy. And that really puts everybody, or at least a lot of people would probably agree on these type of situations, but everybody in this country kind of identifies themselves with the middle class. And I think if we, if the Democratic Party would maybe attach something on to their party as a Democratic Party for common people, common cause, and common sense, I think a lot of people then would probably maybe open up a little bit more in this area. But I really think that the unfortunate thing is that when change occurred during the Great Depression, it was because of a crisis, and we haven't had a severe enough crisis to warn enough people to get upset enough to really think about the issues until it affects them directly in the pocketbook over perhaps a long period of time, which I think is happening. I'd like to hear your comments on that. Thank you.
I like common people, common cause, common sense as a slogan, and I also do agree with the caller in terms of the Democratic Party being louder and more effective on behalf of average working people. One issue that people care deeply about and are worried about is health care. Most people who do have health care, and by the way, 44 million Americans don't have health insurance at all. That's up from 38 million people when Bill Clinton put forward his proposal for universal health care in 1994. But you have 120 million people who are paying much more for health care in health insurance than ever before. Employers are shifting the costs of health insurance onto employees. This would be a natural and important Democratic issue. I think that's why John Kerry has embraced it and come up with a very ambitious health care plan, financed, by the way, by rolling back the taxes and the tax cuts on people earning over $200,000 back to what they were under Bill Clinton, which were not confiscatory by any means. So again, the caller is correct. The Democrats have to have slogans, but also themes and policies that help average working people.
Next caller is Urbana, line number three. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I'm finding your discussion very interesting. I would like to take issue, though, with your definition of conservatives as traditional and radical. It seems to me that the group you call traditional are actually anywhere else in the world, they would have been considered as center-left or centrist and really liberal until the 1930s, perhaps, when Roosevelt defined those who were Republicans as conservatives. At the time, the conservatives actually were almost entirely Democrats, the likes of Bilbo, Talmadge, Strom Thurmond, Bankhead. And these were the true conservatives, still are the true conservatives, although they're almost entirely Republican today. And the Republicans seem to be pruning out this group that you would call traditional conservatives. I would call them traditional liberals, because that's what they would be. Certainly, they're much closer to the center-left of Europe than they are to the conservatives of Europe. The Republicans seem to be pruning this group out of the electoral office. There are only a few left in New England and scattered around the Midwest today. But they still are the bulk of both parties as far as the rank-and-file membership. And it seems to me this constitutes a great instability in the Republican majority or near majority. Actually, it's very closely divided if you look at the House and the voting in recent presidential elections, that there is almost no commonality between the true conservatives, the traditional, old-fashioned segregationist conservatives, and the more progressive conservatives, as you call them, or the more traditional conservatives, and the social conservatives, who are really more closely aligned in interest with the populace and a number of leftist groups than they are with the conservatives, except for some wedge issues which seem to completely define their politics today, but I suspect cannot be maintained. Would you care to comment on this?
Yes, I think that the traditional conservatives, and we can label these things. I mean, labels are difficult to pin down, and I think it's more important to get under labels, and what I try to do in the book is get under the labels and expose the issues and expose what people really believe and why they believe it and where these currents came from. To call Southern Democrats of the 1920s, 1930s traditional conservatives and to equate traditional conservatism with the segregationist and racist policies of Southern Democrats in those of those days, I think doesn't really do service or adequate service to the notions of traditional conservatism that date back to Edmund Burke, the 17th century and early 18th century in Britain. Burke's great 18th century treatise on reflections of the revolution in France called for, instead of revolution, a kind of slowing down of social change, a valuing of tradition, a valuing of basically institutions of government, a fear of sort of disregard of those institutions. But what we see with radical conservatives, such as the people now in power, are people who don't care very much about the institutions themselves. They care much more about the ends rather than the means. The ends seem to justify the means. Whether we're talking about tax policy or we're talking about domestic policy or foreign policy, most of the treaty obligations, Geneva Accords, United Nations, many of the institutions that the United States has painfully developed over the last 20 years have been basically discarded by the radical conservatives who say, well, we only want to assert American power, and that's our goal. Our goal is to get rid of terrorism as we define terrorism, and, well, basically let's turn our back on the institutions we've so carefully crafted. Just another point. The caller said that traditional conservatives were similar to kind of left-of-center Europeans, I don't think that's quite right. The United States as a whole is and has been for many years, even under Franklin D. Roosevelt, usually to the right of Europe. And certainly this has been true over the last 25 years. The people who run Europe and most European public opinion is a democratic socialist. That is, Europeans take for granted that there should be a social state, there should be social insurance, there should be cradle-to-grave social insurance. Most Americans would never tolerate anything this intrusive or the taxes that pay for this kind of a social state. So even the Democratic Party in this country is quite far to the right of the European Social Democrats.
I'm going to jump in here because we are past our midpoint and I have a number of other callers. And I hope the last caller will forgive me as I want to keep going and get in as many people in the conversation as possible. And I also want to introduce again our guest, Robert Reich. He's university professor at Brandeis University. He's also visiting professor at University of California, Berkeley, and he served as Secretary of Labor under President Bill Clinton. He has authored a number of books. His most recent is titled Reason, the subtitle Why Liberals Will Win the Battle for America. Knopf is the publisher. Questions welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Let me just get back real quickly to the comments you were making earlier about Ralph Nader, because I know that there are a lot of people in this area that supported him, at least in the last presidential election, and I'm sure would be unhappy with hearing what you have to say. And not just you, a lot of people, a lot of Democrats who are concerned with retaking the White House say the same thing. They would say that, look, the reason that I voted for Ralph Nader and the reason that I might vote for him again is because I really believe that he's got the right idea about a lot of things, particularly about corporate power. I think I can imagine these people saying, you're not going to get my vote by making the argument that says if you don't vote for John Kerry, you're voting for President Bush. The only way you're going to get my vote is for you, the Democratic Party, to get where I am, you know, to in a sense, adopt some of the same positions that Mr. Nader has taken, which some people might actually even say that's really what Nader wants. He doesn't think he's going to be president. He just wants the Democratic Party to get with the program. Can the Democratic Party do that?
Well, I would say two things. First of all, anybody holding that point of view and voting for Nader is being painfully naive about how a two-party system works. I mean, it is a two-party system in this country because we have a winner-take-all system of electing our presidents. Perhaps we shouldn't. I, for one, think an instant runoff voting system would be far preferable, but we don't have that yet. Maybe we can work for that. But right now, it's a winner-take-all system. And as long as we have a winner-take-all system, it means that if you are sympathetic to progressive and liberal values and you do not vote for John Kerry, you are, in effect, voting for somebody whose values are very, very different from yours. You're helping George Bush get elected. If you want to move the Democratic Party to the left, my advice to you is to do what I've tried to do for years, and that is move it to the left from the inside. Be a loud voice on the inside of the party. It's harder to do. It may take a lot of time, but it is much more effective than trying to do it from the vantage point of a third party. Third parties in America have almost never succeeded because of the winner-take-all quality that we face. And it would be, especially given what would happen in 2000, it would be just a terrible, terrible, painful result for us to endure just another loss as Democrats to a Republican president who represents such conservative values if people vote for Ralph Nader, or even 4% of the likely voters vote for Ralph Nader instead of John Kerry.
Other callers. We have a couple of people here listening in Chicago this morning, so we'll go there first to line number 4 in Chicago. Hello.
Hello. You're talking to a painfully naive person. I'd like to make my first point, which is most Americans are not liberal. Most Americans just want to be comfortable, which is why Mr. Bush has been so successful with his policy of fear. And the fact that the statements that you made about Nader really pains me because they sound basically anti-democratic. And the fact that so many Democrats are taking this line is really distressing, because what I worry about is not the number of people who will vote for Nader, but the number of people who will vote at all. I mean, to my greatest fear is that we'll have only 35% of those eligible to vote this year, because for most people, they cannot see this glaring difference between Bush and Kerry, and that's the real tragedy of John Kerry, and probably why, even as Bush implodes, Kerry cannot gain strength. It's just not visible, especially looking at his voting record since 9/11. Kerry just doesn't stand out as this great difference, except perhaps to white middle-class men. Maybe he does for them, but I think for the rest of the country, he does not. So I think that if the Democrats need to do anything, is that they really need to try to get people out to vote, number one, and then make sure that those who do vote, that their vote is counted.
Well, I couldn't agree more with the caller. You know, in fact, one of the major points I make in my book is that if progressives, liberals, Democrats are going to have a voice at all, they have to organize, mobilize, and energize the almost 50% of the voting public, or the eligible voting public, that does not vote. And the only way to get them mobilized and energized is to have the courage of our convictions and to be clear about what those convictions are. John Kerry has been quite clear. I think the press has not picked up on what he said about health care, his energy policy, how he's distinguished himself from Bush on Iraq and foreign policy. I've listened very carefully because I'm a political junkie and I listen. But the press tends to blur the distinctions and only look at the fights. The press likes the mudslinging. Just getting back to the caller's point about Ralph Nader, I want to make it, and myself, very, very clear. I'm not making an anti-democratic point, small d. I'm making a point about the way our democracy functions. As long as we have a winner-take-all system, as long as our electoral system, our system for electing presidents, basically is that you have the winner of a particular state getting all the electoral votes, then inevitably a third party is going to be draining off votes from the major candidate closest in political ideology and affiliation to that third party. And that means that we saw exactly what happened in 2000. We could see it occur again. I hope not. But anybody who thought that there was no difference between Al Gore and George W. Bush in 2000 has to now have seen that, of course, there was a difference, a major difference. We would not be in our predicament in Iraq. We would not be giving huge tax breaks to the wealthy. We would not be plundering the environment. We would not be assaulting civil liberties right now. If George W. Bush was a moderate, was a compassionate conservative, was basically just like Al Gore. No, there's a huge difference.
Let's
not be fooled again.
I'm sorry. George Bush has been able to do what he did with a lot of Democratic votes in the Congress, and we shouldn't ignore that. And the second point I'd like to make is, as far as I know, John Kerry has said we will stay in Iraq, and he seems to be after this failed policy, or about a definitely will fail policy, of trying to get more other nations involved, which they would absolutely have to be insane to get involved. So I really don't see this vast difference. And that's all I'm going to say, because I know a lot of other people want to speak. But I'm sorry. I don't think it's just the press. I simply think that vast difference doesn't look that vast to people other than white establishment males.
As a white male, I hope I'm not a white establishment male. Maybe I am, having been Secretary of Labor, but I don't think I am. Let me just say very clearly that on Iraq, John Kerry has distinguished him very, very sharply from George W. Bush. John Kerry has said, number one, we are distracting ourselves in Iraq and not really fighting the war against terror. Terrorists are not in Iraq per se. Terrorism is occurring all over the world, and the only way we really fight terrorism is by going after the terrorists, and especially the weapons of mass destruction that are in such places right now as Russia. We ought to be spending money and time and energy making sure that those nuclear materials in Russia are carefully guarded. John Kerry wants to create, in essence, an international police capacity to watch weapons of mass destruction, to prevent the spread of terrorism, to prevent terrorists from getting access to those weapons, to enhance homeland security, and not to occupy foreign nations, not to base a foreign policy upon going after Saddam Hussein's legacy in Iraq. The only reason John Kerry has said we have to stay at least for a time in Iraq is because having done what we've done, and he's very much against what we've done, but having done what we've done, to leave Iraq at this moment would just create chaos. We would end up inviting a bloody, awful civil war, imposing even more hardship on the Iraqis. As long as we've come this far, sadly, we have to at least internationalize it, turn over authority as quickly as possible, and then get out.
We have other callers, and I believe we have another person calling from Chicago. This is next, line number one.
Hello. Yeah, hi. Let me make three or four points very briefly. I hope you'll allow me the time. With respect to the Democratic Party, essentially it's sold its soul through allowing the Democratic Leadership Council to essentially take control of the party. And these are a bunch of people led originally by Clinton and Lieberman and Gore, who put the interests of the business interests first in order to raise money for the party, and essentially they adopted many of the views of the business interests, which were very conservative. No less conservative than much of the Republican point of view. Now, you try to make the distinction between the traditional conservatives and radical conservatives, like the Southern Democrats now. And essentially, this is a distinction without a difference. Basically, the traditional conservatives have always been aligned with the radical conservatives, the Southern Democrats, and these are the guys who have run politics, national politics for the most part, in the United States since the Grant administration. Take a look at, for those who are interested, read the third volume of Lyndon Johnson's biography, and to see how the Senate worked during the time that Lyndon Johnson was there and prior to that. Thirdly, with respect to the average American, they're basically conservatives, and I point to the United Auto Workers, who, during the time of the Ruthers' leadership, were basically in the liberal camp. But now you don't know where they stand, particularly when it comes to environmental problems. They vote with the Republicans. They're afraid of to make changes in the auto industry, and I suppose for good reason, because they fear for the lack of jobs. But basically, they'll vote a reactionary. They'll go with reactionaries, as far as that goes. That is with the Republicans. Now, one more thing, and this goes to a book that you wrote back around 1979 or 80. I forget the title, War and something or other, where you urged the because of technological changes that have been made, we make an effort to educate the population, I guess. This is one point that you made anyhow. And I agree in large part with what you had to say, except that you didn't go far enough, and you pretty much ignored about 30 or 40% of the working population because you didn't have very much to say about those in the lower levels who require re-education, and yet there may not be a possibility in the technological age for retraining them anywhere, and there's no place else to put them.
Yeah, the caller raised a number of points, and we're really coming down to our last 7-8 minutes. I'd just like to give Dr. Rush a chance to respond to some of what you had to say.
There's so many points. Some of them are very good points, and some I agree with. Let me start with the issue of the Democratic Party cozying up to business interests through particularly the Democratic Leadership Council. I tend to agree with that point. I have not been an advocate of the DLC. And I am very concerned about the Democratic Party losing its soul by accepting contributions and soliciting and courting big businesses to the extent that it becomes very difficult for the Democrats to stand up for the little guy, to stand up for ordinary Americans. Secondly, let me just say that, and I say this to anybody who complains about the Democratic Party or complains about unions or complains about the direction we're going in, I hear, as I go around the country, a great deal of whining. Many people are cynical, are despairing, are negative. They whine a lot about politics. And my response to those people is to say, do something. Get off your butt. Don't just whine. This is your country. It's your politics. You need to spend 2 or 3 hours a week. Go to the Democratic caucus in your town. Get involved in local politics. Get involved in state politics. Don't just hold your nose and say, I'm not going to do it, and politics is dirty. No, politics is the applied form of democracy. If you turn your back on politics, you're turning your back on democracy. And if you turn your back on democracy through cynicism and despair, the other side wins. That's what they would like. They'd like all of us to say, oh, the Democratic Party is no good. I'm not going to try to reform the Democratic Party. Oh, I think the unions are basically conservative. I'm not going to even bother with unions anymore. I'm just going to sit and read my newspaper and basically complain. No, that won't do anymore. The stakes are too large. It is absolutely vitally important. And this election coming up is probably the most important election for this country since 1932 in terms of the direction that this country is going in. It's time for everyone to get engaged and involved. It's time for everyone to stop complaining and do something. Get out the vote. Get out the vote in your neighborhood. Make sure your neighbors are voting. Get out the vote among people who don't normally vote. And make sure that people are registered to vote. And make sure that when they are registered and after they have voted, after Election Day, that whoever is in power listens and is forced to listen to the rest of us and can't go off just doing the bidding of big corporations. This is vitally important.
We just have a couple of minutes left. We have some other callers. I want to try to get at least one more. This is someone listening in Avon, Indiana. That's line number 3. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Dr. Reich, thoroughly enjoy your comments, particularly on Marketplace.
Thank you.
More so than when you were in politics, because you're able to, you know, breathe and talk about, you know, what's on your mind. But I would also appreciate having your email address also. I'd like to make a few comments every now and then about your articles. Anyway, my feeling and about politics is that government is for the few and the elite. Joe Sixpacks, you know, we really don't see that many benefits coming from government. They're given, you know, we do get benefits, but then they're taken away. You don't see this happening with the upper structure, particularly with the present type of administration that we have right now in the Congress, the White House, and a lot of our state governments. We got to have change, period. Your ideas, please.
Well, I completely agree. The only reason that the Bush administration was able to pass these tax cuts, the lion's share going to very wealthy people earning over $200,000 a year, is because most Americans decide they just didn't care or were too cynical or assumed that politics were in the hands already of the fat cats and it was no use even bothering. The reason the Bush administration has been able to pull the wool over so many people's eyes with regard to Iraq, getting away with lies about weapons of mass destruction and the relationship between Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden, is, again, most people just throw up their hands. What can I do about American foreign policy? What do I know? I have to trust the president, say most people. Again, I want to ask the caller to commit himself and others of you who are listening to commit yourselves to the extent you possibly can to at least 2 or 3 hours a week engaged in getting out the vote, and registering people who are not registered to vote for this coming election. It's not enough to complain. It's not necessary that politics be just for the fat cats and the big guys and for the big corporations. If we get resigned, if we become sort of despairing and cynical, then the other side wins and we lose our democracy for good.
There we must stop because we have used our time. For people who would like to read more from our guest, look at this recent book that we have been talking about. It's titled Reason, Why Liberals Will Win the Battle for America. It's published by Knopf's. Offered A. Knopf, our guest, Robert Reich, is professor at Brandeis University, and as I have mentioned a couple of times, I'm sure you know, he was Secretary of Labor under President Bill Clinton. Professor Reich, thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much, David. Bye-bye.
Our program, Focus 580, is made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and the coffee bar. Coming up on the next Afternoon Magazine, we'll be taking a look at the global AIDS crisis and the American response to the pandemic. Celeste Quinn, the host for the show, her guest will be Greg Berman, author of the book The Invisible People. He says that America's response has been woeful to a disaster of human misery that poses a threat to global security. That's part of the Afternoon Magazine. Celeste Quinn is the host. Show gets underway at noon here on AM 580. And then the interview with Greg Berman will be in the 1 o'clock hour of the show. As the new fiscal year dawns, and today's the first day, we would like to thank everyone who contributed to WILL over the past year. It's your support that allows us to provide the programs and services that you expect. In a week or two, we'll have the official count, and we will report back to you on how close we came to meeting our listener support goal. In the meantime, we hope that you will enjoy the next year of programming that your support is making possible. And again, you have our thanks. Well, coming up in the next part of Focus 580, we will be taking up a rather different topic. We'll be talking about agriculture in the state of Illinois, and our guest for the program will be Dan Anderson. He helps coordinate the Agroecology Sustainable Ag Program in the U of I College of Agriculture, Consumer Economics, and he will be talking with us about a book that he's put together that looks at farmers around the state of Illinois who are doing things a little bit differently. That is, they are moving away from exclusively raising large crops of corn and soybeans. They're doing some things different. He calls this book A Different Field, Innovative Entrepreneurs in Illinois Farming, and we'll be talking about that in the next part of Focus 580. Right now, we'll hope you'll stay with us. We'll have news at 1 minute past the hour, and right now, an update on the markets.
Agricultural information is made possible in part by a grant from the Archer Daniels Midland Company. ADM, the nature of what's to come.
And coming up on 1059 with this update on the markets, I'm Jay Pierce. Good morning. Well, the July wheat contract is down 6 currently at 332. September wheat down 4 at 341 and a half. Corn also lower. July at 253 and 3 quarters, down 3 and 3 quarters. September at 259, down 3 and a half. December at 263 and a half, down 3 and a half. March 05, corn 271, down 2 and 3 quarters.